Hello and welcome to Ask the Mayor on WBAA. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. Thanks for being with us on the program today. My guest this week speaking to us from his office is Crawfordsville Mayor Todd Barton, and we'd love to have your questions for him during the next half an hour. You can always email those to ask@wbaa.org. You can tweet them at WBAA News on Twitter, and you can call them in to us at 765-496-1999. Mr. Mayor, good afternoon. How are you?
Good afternoon. I'm very good. Thank you.
Thanks for being on the show, as always. Let me get right into it here. We've got a lot to cover here, and it's been an interesting last month or so, so let me try and cram in as much as we can in the next half hour. I noticed that the city has signed a contract to start renovating a building you eventually plan to use to house the county's emergency management offices. I wondered what this new building is going to allow you to do that you haven't been able to do before.
Well, the new building allows us to do quite a few things, actually. It's a building we were able to purchase for a very low price. It's 50,000 square feet, largely of warehouse space. So we will be locating a lot of the items that we were paying to store elsewhere in that building, such as reserve fire engines, the District 4 mass casualty unit. Emergency management has trailers. Red Cross has trailers. The county health department has trailers, so we have all these things, all these assets that we were storing in various places, and we'll be able to put those all in one spot. Also, part of the building is set up to store extra city equipment. For example, our salt brine spray trucks that we use in the winter are stored there in the off season, and then we'll locate the emergency management offices in the front portion so that they are there watching over those assets every day, and there's someone in and out of the building. And then long-term, we have a plan to really start to create a regional public safety training facility at that location. There's certainly room for that, and our police and fire, our SWAT teams have been training in there for the last several months, and the building holds a lot of potential for us.
So with respect to that training facility, what do you plan to do to get that up and running, and who do you plan to market that to?
Well, we're working through plans right now, then we'll have to see what that really looks like and then see what kind of funding is needed. But basically, it's a situation in which public safety entities cooperate with one another from around the state. And really, from what we're hearing on the law enforcement side, probably even more than just Indiana, looking for different places to conduct classes or to have training. With this particular building, we have the ability to create, if you will, mock-up structures inside the building. So you can constantly change the training scenario with movable walls and things like that to really create some very dynamic training, and we're pretty excited about that.
There's no similar facility that already exists?
Not really. There are areas that have facilities that can do pieces of this and different functions, but nobody has really pulled it all together in one spot. And even if there are facilities out there, many times for us anyway, it's cost prohibitive to, pay all of our people and travel somewhere else and do all that. So you get a little bit of that training, but not what we could get with it right in our backyard. And it's something we think we can create at a pretty low cost.
Do you view this as a revenue generator for you long term?
Well, I don't know that it's going to be a profit generator or anything like that. I think it can generate enough revenue to helps offset some of the ongoing expenses with the facility, though.
So with respect to what else the facility can do, you talked a lot about being able to store different things and use the physical space. What about the EMS personnel themselves? Is there anything they'll be able to do or anything that will be made easier for them as they move into the new space, either with technology or location, anything like that?
Right. So emergency management moving to the facility, they're currently located in the basement of City Hall, so they're pretty limited in what they can do, but they will be part of the renovation that's going to be happening, and this will be happening in phases, but part of that is to create real working emergency operating centers that will allow them to do their job if there is, let's say, a tornado or a widespread emergency. When we're talking about emergency management, it is not necessarily that frontline initial response of police and fire and those types. It's what happens after that. How do we get the resources we need into our community to get people food and water and restore electricity and those kinds of things? So it's very important to have that in place, and what they will be able to do in that facility will be much more expanded than what they're capable of doing in the basement of City Hall.
We've heard for a number of years now about EMS consolidation around the state between cities and counties and things like that. And it got me to wondering, you as a former fire chief seem well equipped to answer this. What's the next step? What's the kind of holy grail, if you will, for EMS that you'd like to be able to do, that ideally you'd be able to get to, but that is prohibitive because of space or because of money or because of technology? I mean, where do you think this whole idea of consolidating a bunch of people under one roof is headed toward if everybody has their druthers?
Well, we're talking about emergency management, or EMA, which is vastly different than EMS. EMS being the emergency medical services. This is strictly emergency management, which is, again, that support structure behind EMS and fire and law enforcement. But I think what we're really after here is we know that we have a lot of resources, and I know from my background that typically when you have something large happen, the challenges come from the management perspective. Firefighters know how to be firefighters. Paramedics know how to be paramedics. Police officers understand their job. It's how you pull all that together and coordinate that will make or break what's happening. And that's largely a role of EMA and incident management. So we know by pulling these resources together and co-locating them on a daily basis, we start to build that communication and that understanding of one another and that dialogue, that when the chips are down and bad things are happening, becomes automatic. So it pays huge dividends. And then there's just the reality of the financial side of things, that, you know, they can't all afford to pay to store all these assets and all this equipment in various places around the community. We put it all under one roof, and it's much more economical.
So isn't there a possibility that there is some sort of economy of scale if you put the EMA and the EMS folks all under one roof? I mean, if you could find a way to have a singular center that has connections to police, fire, the county emergency management office, whatever else you need, that would seem to be something you could use for just run-of-the-mill day-to-day police and fire calls, to natural disasters, to active shooters, which I know you guys have trained in Montgomery County on in the last couple of years, right?
Well, I think that's true on the training side and on the support side. I mean, we still have to keep our first responders, so we still have fire stations, and EMS is in the fire stations, and we still have to keep law enforcement scattered throughout the community, and we have police station and we have the sheriff's department. So, you know, we're not going to co-locate those things. But on a training level, co-locating those training facilities makes perfect sense. And again, we're just trying to build that infrastructure and build that system that we really need to support a community our size. You know, you can get by on day-to-day a lot of times with this hodgepodge of things, but believe me, when things aren't going well and something major happens, this needs to be streamlined, and it has to be very efficient and very effective.
As you were talking about all of the different vehicles and things that are going to be located in this new space, it got me to thinking about the idea of a mobile command center. And I remember when I worked in Indianapolis that they had unveiled this big, fancy, schmancy new truck that could be a mobile command center. Does your county currently have anything like that, or do you need something like that?
Well, we have different levels of that. So on a normal response, certainly the fire department has vehicles that serve in that role. Law enforcement obviously follows the same path. And then as we step up another level, we have trailers that are set up both on the fire side and on the law enforcement side that are set up to serve as a meeting place with some communications capability. And then the next level beyond that, District 4, Homeland Security District 4, has a mobile command center that's actually based in the greater Lafayette area that we could bring in as a resource as well. So depending on the size and complexity of the incident, day-to-day we function fine, but if we need to step that up, we have a couple of options that go beyond that.
This is Ask the Mayor on WBAA. We're talking today with Crawfordsville Mayor Todd Barton, and we'd love to have your questions for the program. You can call them in to 765-496-1999. You can send an email to ask@wbaa.org, or you can tweet your questions at WBAA News on Twitter. You and I talked on a previous program about the city bringing back a popular canoe race, but I noticed it had to be postponed, actually, for a little while after the water was too high on the original date in May that you'd hoped to run the race. So it happened more recently. Did the changing of that date affect turnout? Because, and I'm asking because I know you were hoping for some sort of economic boost from that event.
Well, we think it did change it a little, and I will say up front that I was not able to be at the event when the date was changed. But, you know, when you looked at the professional racers, if you will, there was another event scheduled for the weekend that we had to reschedule with. So that pulled some of them away, but, you know, we might have picked up some locals because you're about a month later, so the weather was a little nicer. They had a beautiful weekend for it. My understanding is that the numbers were solid and were about what they expected, and things went very, very well.
On to other economic development topics. You have been involved with a group that's been to D.C. or is going to D.C. To try to worry about how to get more foreign investment. Is that correct?
Right. I was able to spend last weekend and the first part of this week in D.C. with Indiana's delegation to a summit that's called Select USA, which really focuses on, we had attendees from about 64 countries present, basically companies or investors from those countries that are interested in investing in the United States. And it's an economic development group with solely a focus on direct foreign investment in our country. And you know, the fact is that we live in a global economy. We function in a global economy, and every community has foreign investment, and you need to understand that and really work within that to try to enhance that. Try to bring in potentially even more to your community. So I think the state's team was very well equipped and very successful, and a lot of discussion occurring with companies from several different countries, and we'll see where some of that goes.
I'm curious about any comments you might have gotten from international business folks, because clearly the talk on the national level from the Trump administration has been this America first push and wanting to get as much domestic investment and help to domestic companies as possible. Did that come up at all?
No, that absolutely came up, and it was an interesting thing that we had to feel our way through, because some of the keynote speakers, actually all the keynote speakers, were from the Trump administration and spoke passionately about foreign companies investing in the United States, and now is the time, and pointed to certain economic indicators. So they certainly heard a loud and clear message from the administration that's being encouraged. Now, as we met with those foreign investors one-on-one, or, you know, like the Indiana delegation, members of us meeting with them, it was certainly a topic that was discussed in those meetings, and it was clear that they're still trying to feel their way through that. They're not really sure what that looks like. They know what they heard, but they have questions, you know, how will the immigration piece work, if we need to send employees back and forth, and some of those issues. So I think there was a message there, but I think there's still a lot of unanswered questions.
Well, it seems like the message is more than a little garbled from Washington, because on one hand, you can't say America first and we want domestic investment, and also at the same time say, oh, by the way, we'd like to close the trade gap with Asia at the same time, which can be done through foreign investment.
Yeah, it is a little confusing at times, I'll tell you that. But, you know, what was very clear to me is that these other groups are extremely interested in investing in the United States. And I think that was kind of eye-opening to me. You know, if I look around our region, you see, you know, really heavy investment from Japanese corporations and, you know, some other nations. So there is still a very strong interest there. And I agree that we need to focus on entrepreneurs and our American companies. But I think we have to accept the reality that many of our employers in our various communities are foreign-owned, and we have to understand that, and we have to make sure we are doing everything we can to make sure that we're protecting the jobs that exist in our communities.
So when you're a part of delegations like that, how do you carve out a spot for a small to mid-sized community like yours as part of the message of, you know, you could come locate in Crawfordsville, but then people wouldn't have to look very far to say, well, you know, we're not far from Indianapolis there, or not far from Chicago. How do you stake your claim that way?
Well, you really wear two hats there. You're representing the state, I think, first and foremost. And when companies look, they're really looking at states first and then regions. So they're not really so much focused on specific cities or communities. And there are certain applications. They want to be in a more metro area, such as the greater Indianapolis area, and then there's some that want to be outside of that area. So you have to kind of, sort through it and try to figure out what they're after and where they might want to be located, and then start, pointing them in the direction of potential sites. And that's what we did. And, I was able to, I think, get some solid leads for Crawfordsville and Montgomery County, but a lot of what I did there, is getting pointed in other directions around the state of Indiana. But ultimately, we know, if we pull something into the state, it's a win for all of us.
While we're talking about communicating with businesses, you've been making some visits this month to businesses in your community that have received tax abatements. How have you talked with the people, especially if there's anyone who's not quite meeting the projections that they originally made for job creation, economic development, things like that?
Well, the good news is that I think with the exception of one, everybody is meeting or exceeding what they projected. So that's a really good situation to find ourselves in. the one that's not, has kind of gone through some contract changes and lost a major customer. So, again, that's part of the reason we do these visits, so we understand the story behind the numbers. And these visits are not required. Basically, these companies are required to fill out a form that goes before the city council, and they review it and vote whether or not to continue the abatement. When I took office, I didn't think that made much sense. So we started these visits, and we asked these companies to come to the city council meeting and to explain to the council the story behind the numbers. And like I said, in most cases, it's a very positive story. You'll have an exception here and there that there's been something unforeseen, like losing a major contract. So, and then while we're there for these visits, we take it to the next level and really engage them in a discussion about how things are going, and try to find out if there's anything that they need to be more successful in our community. So it's a discussion with their local leadership, and we always are aware that there's probably leadership above them, and that's, maybe that's leadership somewhere here in the States, or maybe it's leadership outside of the United States. But at least we engage in the dialogue on a local level.
You talked about understanding the individual story of each company. So let me ask, how strict are you with respect to what the city's agreements are? For instance, if a company says it'll create, say, 35 jobs and they create 34, what happens then?
Well, the council has to make that decision. And, state law spells out how they make that decision and what they must do and what they must consider in making that decision. So, like most things, what you'll find is state law really ties the hands of the city council in that case. But ultimately, it's their decision to determine that, yes, we're going to continue this or we're not going to continue this. And I will say that based on the state law and based on what's happened here in the past, if they're off a little bit, we work with that and we go on and we attempt to understand that. Now, if somebody was grossly off, that would be a different story, and we would have to really engage legal to sort through how we move through making changes to that abatement.
So there is a threshold at which you say, all right, there are some shenanigans here that we need to look into.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think we've ever run into a situation where I would call it shenanigans, but certainly an abatement is applied for and then maybe the project doesn't happen. In that case, it's cut and dry that the abatement, it's not there. It doesn't exist because there's nothing to abate. But there are cases where they might, miss their employment numbers by a few. And the really weird thing is this form has to be filled out, and I'm going to get in trouble here. I don't know the exact dates, but it's sometime in the winter. But yet the council considers it in the summer. So you still have a few months gap there, and typically you'll find when they come in, well, those were the numbers when we filled the form out. These are the numbers today, and that may be up or down. So there's a lot to consider there.
So businesses are sort of projecting right alongside you, and you're hoping that they get their projections right.
Absolutely. And like I say, in many cases, they've exceeded their projections, which is good.
Is it ever the case that bigger companies, you and I talked about, for instance, a couple of years ago, Penguin Publishing deciding whether or not to stay its operation in Crawfordsville. If you've got a bigger company, do they get any more leeway, especially if they are promising you more in terms of job creation, economic gains, anything like that? Does that give them more ability to have an abatement crafted in their favor?
No, the size of the company doesn't really drive any of this. We follow a formula that's that's based on state statute that's adopted into city ordinance, and simply following that formula and calculating based on increased assessed value and increased jobs, what they're eligible for, what they're not. So the size of the company behind it wouldn't really directly affect that. It's what they plan to do here. And again, they have to live up to that end of the deal. And that's oftentimes being matched up or married up with what the state's offering in incentives as well. And again, those are performance-based. So I think there's a lot of misconception out there that these companies are getting cash up front and may or may not live up to the expectations. And that's not how we do business. This is an abatement is simply deferring what they're paying to allow them to get up and running. So without the abatement, you're not going to, you know, if they don't make the investment, you're never going to get the taxes. If you abate it, you're going to start easing those in a little bit slower than you would without the abatement if the investment actually occurred.
As you've been looking at how all of the Stellar Community stuff might change Crawfordsville, especially in the next 5 to 10 years, has that changed your thinking at all? Do you foresee it, for instance, becoming maybe harder in the future to get an abatement if you get competition to invest in the city, for instance?
Well, you hope to get yourself in a situation where, you know, maybe you don't need as much abatement, but the reality is we're not competing against ourselves. We're competing with the community down the road or the community in another state. And, you know, you can slice abatement in different ways and say it's a good thing or a horrible thing. The reality is it's something that communities around the country are doing, and you have to gauge a couple of things when you consider abatement. You know, yes, what are they planning to do, but also what is the competition? I mean, if you sense that they're coming here no matter what, then abatement's not really a tool you need. If you sense that you really are in competition with community X somewhere else, then it's a tool that you need to bring to the table. So a lot of sorting through there to try to figure out what the competition is really like. And you know, you brought up the Penguin example a little bit ago. We knew in that case we were in direct head-to-head competition with an East Coast community, and that was a case we had to really seriously look at this and apply abatement.
As you're looking at the length of an abatement, especially as you're thinking about how you might want to see Crawfordsville change in the next 5 to 10 years, does the timeline of what you'd like to see the city become change the way that you think about who you might like to have be your investors in 2, 3, 5, 10 years?
Well, you have to consider those things. And, you know, as we look at how this community is moving forward, there's several things that come into play. And, you know, we just recently annexed some area into the city for housing. We have a renewed focus on recruiting retail and restaurants into the community. We are making drastic changes to our economic development approach. So I think all those things come together to match up with the changes in quality of life. But the goal is to grow the community and to have good quality jobs. So you have to weigh that out. And if you get opportunities that you think don't fit with your community, sometimes you got to make some tough calls and think, you know, say, well, this is not something we're going to put incentives on the table because we don't think this grows the community. And for example, a lot of communities have made the decision to forego logistics or distribution types of opportunities because those tend to be only entry level, not much advancement, lower wages, you know, and those kind of things. So it's hard to get people to understand that because people drive through other communities and see all these warehouses and think, wow, you know, they have all this expansion. Well, they're all logistics. And so you certainly need some of that. I'm not saying you don't. We have some, and it's a great entry-level position and really gets people started in the workforce. But I think at some point you have to make a decision how much of that you want. So, yes, I guess the short answer is you do have to consider what types of things you're bringing in.
It's been several months since we talked on the show here about the Human Rights Commission, and I didn't realize it until I saw it on the city's website today as I was looking at it again, that it was probably about 2 years ago that you and I started talking about this. It didn't have its first meetings until earlier this year, but I wanted to check in and see what progress that board had made in that last few months.
Well, you know, I think they're doing very well, and I said all along that they would have to kind of get their legs under them and start to really figure out what was going on and how they were going to approach things, and that's kind of been the case. I've not personally been able to attend the last couple of meetings because I've been tied up with something else. But I know they did meet this week, and it's summertime. So, you know, you get a lot of people going in various directions, and it's hard to get a quorum sometimes. But they already have completed their look at our existing city ordinances. So they split up the workload, and they've looked at every ordinance the city has on the books. And they've given us some initial feedback of things that we ought to consider changing according to what they see. So we're looking at that right now and probably be taking some things to the city council down the road. So they've done that. That was one of the first jobs they were tasked with. And then I know they have fielded a few concerns, one in particular I'm aware of, and they met with a business owner. They met with the people with the concern and really facilitated a communication or some dialogue there. And what we figured would happen has largely happened. You get some communication barriers in the way and some communication problems. They were able to sort through that and work through that, and I think everybody was satisfied with the result in the end. So they're taking on various roles. I know they're sponsoring some educational activities that I don't think they're quite ready to announce yet, but they'll be rolling those out pretty soon as well.
With respect to the look they've taken at all of the city ordinances, is it mostly just taking a look at the language, you know, making sure that, you know, pronouns are not gender specific or something
right,
that? Or is it trying to find ordinances that were written in such a way that they might be considered racist, bigoted, et cetera?
It's both. It's both. And a lot of what they've come back with has been the language or the wording. There have been a few instances in which they pointed out that, you know, this the wording maybe does indicate, you know, something that we need to think about. So really not much of that, but there was a little bit of that. And like I said, we're kind of working that through now, and we'll probably take those to the city council so they can look at those things. You know, the most glaring thing that comes out of a review like that is really a discussion begins to happen about, you know, protected classes and where we want those to be versus where we do not want those to be as a community. And that discussion has started, and the discussion has started with this group. So we're far from, I think, sorting that out, but I think that will happen in the coming months.
Any idea how long it might take the city council to think about and then perhaps adopt any changes that are suggested to it?
Well, from the time it hits their agenda, I think you're probably looking at a couple of months, maybe three if things get stretched out. So, you know, it won't take them long once we really work through and give them some clear choices. We don't want to just throw something ambiguous on the table. We want to say, you know, here's what the Human Rights Commission has suggested. Here's potential wording. Here are a couple options, some things to think about, and then let them go from there. So it won't take long once they get it.
All right. Well, Mr. Mayor, thanks as always for your time. That's all the time we have on the program for this month. But good news is I've got more questions left that we can talk about on next month's show.
Very good. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot. Have a good day. And this has been Ask the Mayor on WBAA. Remember, you can always email questions for any of our four mayors. Our email address is ask@wbaa.org. You can tweet those questions at WBAA News on Twitter. And remember that all of these shows are archived at our website, wbaa.org. You can find the Ask the Mayor page, and you can listen to back episodes of Ask the Mayor on our WBAA mobile app, which you can download for free to your smartphone or Android device or iPad. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. Enjoy the rest of your day.